For the week of October 25th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 26, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Orlando, Florida, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And always in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And inside my mailbox in New York City, I'm Michael Giltz.
Also joining us today, we have Todd Gilchrist, who is a freelance writer and film critic. You can find his work on Cinematical, Sci-Fi Wire, and a number of other online outlets. Todd, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, besides Cinematical and Sci-Fi Wire, what are you up to these days?
Basically, I've been covering movies and pop culture for a number of different online and print outlets. Write some stuff for Play Magazine. I do stuff for Beat Crave, so I write music. I just started a film critic position. I started as a film critic for bitterlawyer.com, which the website is pretty self-explanatory, but despite my lack of expertise in legal things, they like to have me review stuff like Amelia and Law Abiding Citizen.
Well, Michael is about to tell us how some of those films fared this weekend in the box office results.
Absolutely. I'm fascinated to know what legal issues arise from Amelia, but maybe it's dealing with her estate. But anyway, the movies over this weekend, Paranormal Activity was the number one film with $22 million. It's just, it is truly a Blair Witch type phenomenon. Number two was Saw 6 with $14.8 million. A soft opening hurt a little bit by Paranormal, about half of what it the last few have been. Number three was Where the Wild Things Are with $14.4 million. That dropped 55-56%, so it's not having great word of mouth. It's definitely an odd, lovable little film. Number four is Law Abiding Citizen with $12.7 million. That's at $40 million total. Number five was Couples Retreat, the controversial film, at $11 million. That's at $78 million total. Astro Boy barely opened, the animated film, with $7 million. The Stepfather, again, took a big hit thanks to Saw 6 and Paranormal Activity. That's at $6.5 million, but it'll be profitable. Cirque du Freak, the Vampire's Assistant, was at $6.3 million. That's based on a children's book. It involves vampires, and it barely opened. Clyde with a Chance of Meatballs is at $115 million. Zombieland is added on another $4.3 million. And Amelia went modestly wide with 800 screens, and that made $4 million, which is probably a little weak and a little disappointing for them. Now, what the heck does Amelia have to do with legal issues, I wonder?
Well, really nothing, quite frankly. I mean, essentially, when I started, we discussed what I would be covering for them, and unfortunately, it seems like there aren't as many John Grisham adaptations as there used to be. but after Law Abiding Citizen, they basically just sort of posited to me to find things that essentially would be sort of taste-making, or maybe lack of taste-making, for their readership. And, you know, looking at the for example, the releases that came out last week, Astro Boy, Cirque du Freak, Saw, and Amelia, that seemed like the one that would be best suited for their readers.
Yeah. Well, what did you think of the film?
Honestly, I think that it's I think it's very well acted, and I think that it's handsomely mounted, but it's kind of bloodless. There's not a whole lot of real dramatic weight to it. I mean, you feel like, for example, I read Roger Ebert's review, and he had said something to the effect of, I guess it's hard to make an adaptation of a life that's essentially happy. I sort of feel like even in the 30s, you know, whether or not she became sort of an overnight celebrity and had a lot of things easy, I feel like there was more conflict or more drama in her life than they really depicted. And so even though, again, I think she and Richard Gere, Hilary Swank and Richard Gere are really good, the movie just doesn't have anything to it that is particularly sort of, you know, that I think is going to connect with the audience more than sort of an automatic sort of Oscar bait kind of nobility.
Well, a movie that did have some teeth was Paranormal Activity, which I think is in its third week. I'm not sure.
But fifth week,
and it's already made $62 million, and the film was made for, it looks like, $15,000. Paramount picked it up for $300,000 and put another $10 million in marketing into it, and they're so happy with this film because they realize now it's going to make $100 million domestically that it seems as if they're going to make a Paranormal Activities 2, according to Brad Gray, who is the chairman of Paramount. He said, "We have the rights on a worldwide basis to do Paranormal 2, and we're looking to see if that makes some sense." It seems as if it would make some sense. This was, of course, in the Los Angeles Times.
Yeah, according to Brad Gray and anyone with a pulse, of course they're going to make a sequel.
Whether it's going to be good is something else entirely.
Well, that's right, Karen, because Book of Shadows, which was the 2000 follow-up to 1999's indie horror phenomenon, which you mentioned earlier, Michael, The Blair Witch Project, was very poorly received, and it grossed only $26.4 million, while The Blair Witch Project grossed $140.6 million.
The interesting thing about all this is that, of course, the original plan for Paranormal Activity was that the studio purchased it and was going to remake it with, you know, recognizable stars. And then, of course, it comes out as it is, although I know that they changed the ending, so there were some different aspects of it from when it got picked up a couple of years ago to when it got released. But essentially, this is like the original film that it was, and having no stars and being extremely inexpensive, I think all those things contribute to word of mouth. And their marketing campaign, although I think that they probably should have been a little bit more aggressive in terms of doing it before the weekend that Saw came out, was really smart. But as a result, I wonder how, given the fact that their original plan was to remake it in the first place, what a sequel really could be. Because I feel like this is one of those kind of lightning in a bottle kind of, you know, experiences where watching a second one feels a little bit too, you know, I mean, you end up with a Blair Witch 2, unfortunately.
Yeah, I agree. This to me is like lightning in a bottle. It's a phenomenon, just like Blair Witch was. And people like the idea that they've discovered it themselves, even though they technically haven't. But as soon as you get a sequel involved, people feel marketed to and they'll pass.
Well, it seems as if they passed on Saw 6. It seems as if that franchise has run out of steam. Certainly it did in the United States. And it most definitely did overseas, where I think it only made $4 million.
Yeah, but will it be profitable?
How could those movies not be profitable?
That's what I'm saying.
The movie only cost $11 million to make. So, and it made $14 in its first weekend.
Well, these are movies that it will always, at least the Saw movies, will always, I think, always make their movie, their money back. I'm not sure that the franchise will last beyond its next installment, which they've already announced. I mean, that's definitely happening, and it's going to happen in 3D. But and truth be told, they originally planned to stop the series at 6, and it had been so successful in previous installments that they decided they were going to build in a 7th. But I think that this may be an indication that sort of the tide of public opinion and or appetite for these, for this particular franchise, has sort of started to wane. And so I think that they'll probably get one more out of it. And, you know, unless they like literally have no competition next year, which I can't imagine. I mean, there have been at least 6 or 7 horror movies released in the past 3 weeks.
Well, Michael, next week you very well may be eating some crow, because you originally said that the Michael Jackson This Is It movie could never make back the $60 million that Sony paid for it. And right now, it seems to be tracking very well. It's tracking to about $65 million in North America as an opening weekend.
Actually, what I said was that it was a very bad bet. Didn't say it was impossible. It's a bad bet, and it still looks like a really bad bet to me. The movie is tracking strongly female. No men seem interested in seeing it at all. They haven't sold on day yet. There's still tickets available for opening day. That's not a movie that's wildly in demand. A movie that's going to open good, 30 to 50 million, and then it's going to drop like a rock. And as soon as people see it on opening day, when they Twitter and Facebook each other and say, "Ugh, you know what? It's like rehearsal footage." there's high demand. People will be there opening day, and then I bet it drops. That's my prediction. But still, it's not going to make 120 million.
Well, Harry Medved from Fandango said, he sent me an email that said today, Monday, 61% of all sales on Fandango, which is a very large online movie ticket seller in North America, 61% of the sales on that website are for This Is It. And it seems as if they did an online survey of 200,000 interested parties. 13% of This Is It moviegoers plan to see the film on opening night. 15% will see it on Wednesday, and 57% will see it some other time during the opening week. It does seem like everybody is in agreement, at least here at Show East in Orlando, that the film will open huge and then drop like a rock.
Hmm. But haven't tickets been pre-sold? I mean, people have already bought them, right?
Yes, 1,000 screenings or 1,000 showings have sold out completely.
Right. Opening day is not sold out yet. What do you think, Todd?
I'm inclined to agree that it's going to have a pretty significant opening weekend and then drop off precipitously. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm curious to see how much longer or how long this sort of Michael Jackson deification will continue. You know, and I think that this is going to probably benefit the most from it. But I question whether or not it will have any sort of real legs. I mean, it's something to me that I think people will go see out of curiosity, and then after that, they'll, having seen it, will, you know, move on to the next thing to obsess about.
What's interesting to me is that 45% of the people polled by Fandango said they plan to see the film more than once in the movie theater, which is kind of a pretty big number, and that's exactly how movies become hits, is by people returning to the theater to see it a second or third time.
But that's a push poll on Fandango where you go in yourself and decide to answer it. I mean, it's a people who go to Fandango website, which is wildly enthusiastic moviegoers, and they're choosing to go into that survey. So it's not a poll or of any real note. It's just a fun online entertainment thing, but it has no statistical meaning whatsoever. It's just total blarney.
Yes, well, it's so blarney that if you look at some of the poll questions, one of them is 70% of respondents have attempted to do the Thriller dance at least once in their lifetime. I'm like, why would you ask that question?
Karen,
well,
did you
actually,
say
more importantly, have any of you guys done it?
Only when I'm a prisoner in Thailand.
Only when I'm drunk at a wedding. That was the last time I did it.
Now, Michael, your reference is, of course, to the viral YouTube video in which a Thai prison got all of their inmates to do the whole video dance.
Exactly.
Right.
I went to see Amelia this weekend, and I have to agree with Todd. I found it very bloodless, uninvolving. It was bizarrely unrevealing. It just was very surfacey. I had no idea whether even Amelia Earhart is a good pilot or not. No idea why Richard Gere wasn't married before he met her. He's this handsome, middle-aged, wealthy, you know, man. Why isn't he married or divorced or his wife dead or something? I have no idea why Ewan McGregor. I just don't know anything about anyone. I'm not even sure if the finale sticks to the facts of history, but maybe they do. But I found it very underwhelming.
Well, now we've got a ton of news to cover today. We're going to eventually get to some television news. We're going to go over some mid-season pickups or some back nine pickups so we can continue that game. Of course, we're going to play Big Deal and Big Whoop. And we're going to talk about Lil Wayne, who pleaded guilty to a gun charge. But let's stick with some movie news first, or at least some semi-movie news. This is about Netflix. Their profit rose by 48%. This is the Rent, a DVD by mail company here in North America. They added 510,000 new subscribers over the course of Q3, with total subscribers up 28% year over year. And paid subscribers represent about 98% of Netflix's revenue. Sorry, 98% of their member base. The company's revenue came in at $423.1 million for a profit of 52 cents per share, which is up 48% for the third quarter versus the third quarter last year. And in a statement, CEO Reed Hastings attributed the growth to Netflix's differentiated offering of both DVDs by mail and streaming online.
Plus a recession.
Yeah,
that's the other reason.
Yeah.
Todd, are you a member of Netflix?
I'm actually not. The truth is that I review so many Blu-rays that I get a lot of stuff, Blu-rays and DVDs that I get a lot of stuff sent to me. And I see so many things in the theater because I'm reviewing them when they're released theatrically that I just don't even have time to watch that many movies. But I actually think that part of the reason for this increased success of Netflix is that that DVDs have reached a point where VHS was when DVDs sort of started becoming a prominent format, which is that people were renting as opposed to buying. I mean, when DVD started, everybody just bought a movie because it was on DVD. It was like it didn't even matter. And I know this was the case for me because I would buy movies that I didn't even like where I was like, oh, this is out on DVD, I'll pick it up. And I think that what has happened is that sort of initial rush to purchase to own has sort of abated, not the least of which because of the economy. And I think that now people, either because of the ascendancy of Blu-ray or just because of the ubiquitousness of DVD, I think they're really in a position now where they really do just go, I don't need to keep this. I don't need to keep every movie that I see or every movie that I want to watch. And so now something like Netflix is really finding, I mean, it's obviously huge already, but I think that it's finding an even better groove for people either who just want to rent random movies or who maybe want to test out the potential and the possibilities of a Blu-ray. And so I think it provides like a kind of consumer service just then watching a movie. And so that's what I would probably attribute to its sort of increased success.
Now, what you're talking about with more viewers renting rather than buying DVDs is actually hurting the studios, and Paramount has angered a number of exhibitors by releasing G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra on November 3rd, just 88 days after it was in theaters. They're also releasing the Jeremy Piven comedy, which nobody saw in theaters, The Goods, Live Hard, Sell Hard. And a lot of people are speculating they're doing this to catch holiday disc sales, which I would agree with, but it has really angered theater owners, movie theater owners, and it's a huge topic of conversation here at Show East. John Fithian, the National Association of Theater Owners president, said, "Our members are ballistic. We don't know what Paramount is up to, but it's highly objectionable." You know, as somebody who works in this space, I can tell you that it really, I don't know, there's a really big divide over people who don't work in motion picture exhibition, who think that you should release films on all formats at once, and then movie theater owners who think that the release pattern should be tiered much the way hardback books are and paperback books are. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that they have yet to prove, I think any studio has yet to prove that empirically releasing something on multiple formats is the best way for it to make the most money. Magnet Releasing or Magnolia have certainly done that a number of times with their movies. And they, those are small platform releases. I had a colleague who suggested they should have released Paranormal Activity on DVD or Blu-ray at the end of the month. And I think that given the sort of underground cult, sleeper success of that movie, I think that might have worked as a unique example. But I think as a rule, I think there needs to be some sort of structure in place where there's a theatrical release and then the home video release. And I think that's not just because of monetary reasons, but I think the idea is that there are a lot of movies that deserve and need to be seen on the big screen. And, a lot of filmmakers would probably be unhappy with the prospect of their film debuting on the small screen when they made it, to be shown in IMAX or shown on a gigantic multiplex screen.
Now, the irony in this is that the LA Times is reporting that movie fans may have to wait to rent new DVDs. There was a story, I believe it was on Friday, that some studios are thinking, Paramount being one of them, by the way, they are thinking of releasing DVDs first for sale. So they would release it to the public and you would have to buy it if you wanted to see it. And then a few weeks later, they would release it for rent and they would give it to Netflix and Redbox.
Well, this is so stupid. It sort of flips what they used to do. They used to charge top dollar for renting movies. They'd sell them for $90 to the stores, and people would rent them. And then 6 months or a year later, if ever, they put them out for sale. And they were forced into realizing that people actually wanted to buy movies when they started pricing VHS tapes at $20 or $25. And DVDs started as a sell-through item, and the studios were all against that. They thought that was a horrible idea. They wanted to do the same thing, charge $90, $100 rental, and then 6 months later, and then what did they do? We ignored what they wanted, and suddenly you had the DVD market being a $16, $20 billion market. Now, they always just try and second guess themselves and try and force people to do what they want rather than just reacting to what the audience wants. The audience wants to be able to rent movies, a few months after the movie comes out in the theater. And, if that's what people want to do, they should do it. And if you've got a big $200 million movie, no one's going to say, hey, let's release it on video and pay-per-view the same day. That would be moronic.
It really does seem as if they're trying to maintain their business model at all costs. This year, the 9% rise in DVD rental revenue came mostly, if not entirely, from Netflix and Redbox. And I think that's what the studios are trying to combat. Reed Hastings, the Netflix CEO, said the studios are wrestling with declines in DVD sales while the DVD rental market has been modestly growing.
But Todd's right. People, you know, they buy a library, they get 20 DVDs, and they're not going to keep buying a million movies every month when it's new. They build a bit of a library, and then they slow down and they buy something every once in a while and rent a lot. That's the normal pattern. And the studios act like, why aren't people buying 40 DVDs a year? Well, it's just not what anyone's going to do.
One thing that might benefit the rental companies such as Netflix and Redbox is the fact that if studios do go through with this, then the rental companies will be able to ask for lower rental percentages.
But Redbox only has a deal with one studio. I believe it's Paramount. Everybody else, they just buy their DVDs from a wholesaler and just rent them when they want. And their studios are not going to be able to stop them from walking into a Walmart, buying a DVD, and then renting them in their kiosks. They're going to have a lawsuit on their hands. You know, they hate it, but they should make a deal with them and share in the revenue like Paramount did.
Well, moving on to a story that was sent in by one of our readers. They emailed it in to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, if you want to, you can also submit a story suggestion to us via delicious.com, the social bookmarking website. Just tag the story, Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. The story was called The Last Picture Show, a Sequel. It was written by David Thompson, a very well-known film historian. And it's effectively about cinema falling apart, at least according to Francis Ford Coppola. However sad, this is a familiar refrain. So I guess Francis Ford Coppola was somewhere in the world talking about how cinema is dying, and David Thompson, who is a cinema historian, was saying, you know, enough already, we've heard it before. Did any of you read this story?
I didn't read the story, but I would be very curious to understand in what way that cinema is dying is meant. I mean, in the sense that, like, what, the artistry of it, or the exhibition of it, or, you know, I mean, that's really, you can speak to this, I'm sure.
Well, he says the audience was no longer as crazy about movies. They had so many other things to do. And the great films of the 70s, think of the first two parts of The Godfather, think of Apocalypse Now, gee, two movies he directed, had come down to images so small on the internet that 70-year-olds, like Coppola himself, could hardly see them. There were days when it seemed as if movies might be over.
First of all, I don't think movies are ever going anywhere. But second of all, why is this always a story? Like, every year it's a story that movies are dying. No, they're not. They're finding other outlets.
And I agree with that. I don't think movies are going anywhere. I mean, I think the appetites of moviegoers are not necessarily altogether that different. I mean, I've always believed that there are, as I think the percentage is different because there are more movies made now, but or the number of movies is different, but the percentage of good versus bad is not altogether that radically different. I mean, there were great movies made in the 70s, but there were crappy ones made in the 70s too, and that's why we don't remember them. You know, I think by and large, you know, there's no dearth of great cinema happening now. I think the problem is that all the stuff we've just been talking about is the idea of studios trying to predict or presage what audiences want, what their appetites are. And, you know, I mean, the truth is that Paranormal Activity, District 9, these are movies that are perfect examples of stuff that the studios didn't know exactly what to do, and they ended up becoming these huge, not only commercial hits, but artistic successes, and they came out of nowhere. And so the studios are going to try to jump on that, and then, you know, they'll you know, sort of mine that new subgenre or idea into its own irrelevancy. And in the meantime, something else would come up. So I don't think that, you know, the movies are going anywhere. I think that, you know, the problem is that our memory, our collective memory, you know, has a tendency to remember as much of the bad as it is good in the sort of immediate context, without realizing that, of course, like in 5 years, you know, nobody's going to remember these movies that we think suck now.
Now, Thompson goes on to write in his piece, "The stars, the genres, the craft, and the business confidence no longer exist. Yet anyone who has ever seen a movie harks back to a fundamental need. Tell me a story I've never heard before. Unless, and this is the gravest anxiety of all, we no longer credit the equation between fresh stories and hopes for the world. In 1939, Gone with the Wind was what it was because the audience feared war and hunger. The film flourished because the romance of hope was still alive. If the movies are in retreat, Is it because our capacity for hoping has withered? What do you think, Michael?
I think Thompson was trying to make a bit more of a movies aren't at the center of our culture point, which you could argue endlessly. But rather bizarrely, in the paragraph before that, he says, you know, educated filmgoers can go at home and watch DVDs of classic movies like Passion of Joan of Arc and The Lady Eve. And then he says, bizarrely, he says, few of those watching those films are likely to be persuaded to go out to see Zombieland, Inglourious Basterds, or Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs for £10 a ticket. Well, those are actually three good to very good movies that got great reviews and a lot of fun. And I think any movie buff would be would absolutely want to see those, as well as, you know, classics like Lady Eve. I mean, they don't match those, of course, but these are three fun movies. But Coppola, you know, it's not movies that are dying, it's Coppola. But the old cranky directors always do this stuff. And again, like I said last week, movie ticket sales, which is the best barometer, have gone up from the 50s to the 60s to the 70s to the 80s to the 90s to today. It's a straight line up. Movie ticket sales have increased every year, along with DVD sales and all those other ways people consume movies now. People watch movies and go to see them and spend more money on them than ever before.
Well, at least in movie theaters, ticket sales have plateaued and gone down over the past
year. No, not true. Not decade by decade.
Not decade by decade, but year by year they have.
No. You've got to look at it. You can't look this. People do that all the time. They say, oh, no, this weekend was down compared to last weekend. Last year, it's $32 million less. And then the next weekend is up 14%. No, look at it decade by decade. The 90s sold more tickets than the 80s. The 80s sold more tickets than the 70s. The 70s sold more tickets than the 60s. And the noughts are almost certainly going to sell more tickets than the 90s. That is a straight line up. You can go week by week and month by month all you want. But more ticket sales are going to be sold in this decade than the decade before. And people are spending billions of dollars on DVDs, which they never did before. So people are spending more money and seeing movies in the theater more than they ever have, except in the 20s and 30s when it was an entirely different beast.
Well, I would be interested to know whether the increase in ticket sales has kept pace with the increase in population. That would be an interesting study, and I might actually do that for Celluloid Junkie. In the meantime, I wonder, have any of you watched television this week, and did you notice something in any of the programs or any of the commercials you were seeing?
You know, that's
nope,
a stupid question,
about?
Asking Michael and I whether we've watched television this week.
Of course we did, but I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I tried to make my question incredibly vague on purpose. Actually, I didn't. I just completely didn't know how to ask that question or to change the subject. My segue was poor. There was a story in the LA Times by Matea Gold and Elena Fernandez about community service as a TV theme. And apparently 100 programs on ABC, CBS, Fox, NBC, and a couple of cable networks were, quote unquote, giving back through storylines or public service announcements. I saw a couple of these last week and the week before. The doctors on ABC's Private Practice give homeless teenagers free checkups. On NBC's 30 Rock, Paige Kenneth Parcel tries to adopt all the dogs at an animal shelter. And two characters on CBS's Numbers talk about joining Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And I saw on Fox the Emily Dashnell do a PSA. Did any of you see any of these?
Well, I did, because I was watching postseason on postseason baseball. So that's the only reason I saw the commercials. So I did see that. What about you, Todd?
Honestly, I don't watch a lot of TV, so I didn't see any of those things.
Oh.
I'm sorry to say.
Well, there's some. I love the fact that the storylines were developed for I Participate, which is this industry-wide initiative aimed at urging viewers to volunteer and give back to their communities. And it was then spearheaded by the Entertainment Industry Foundation, which is a Hollywood charitable organization. And they were the force behind last year's Stand Up to Cancer telethon. And because of this, all of these right-wing groups came out and said that, oh, it's, you know, an anti-abortion campaign. And Matea Gold and Elena Fernandez write, but while the project has found widespread support in Hollywood, its dovetailing with President Obama's call for national service has fueled suspicion in some conservative circles that I Participate is an effort to prop up left-wing causes.
Yes, helping your fellow neighbor is now a left-wing cause.
I mean, I did see the PSA because I watch a lot of Fox TV, but there was a PSA on Greek, during Greek, which is, I am embarrassed to admit, is my favorite guilty pleasure show. And it was about, like, safe sex and condoms and you know, being responsible. So I don't know if that was part of this campaign, but it certainly fits. It's interesting.
I'm sure it was. Now, Michael, Karen, I know you both love Glee, the show that is on Fox that is kind of a musical one-hour drama. And Joss Whedon, who is presently the producer of Dollhouse and, of course, brought us the Buffy the Vampire Slayer series, he's going to direct an episode of Glee. Are you excited about that?
I'm not a Joss Whedon fan, so yes, I know, kill me now. The thing that I'm most concerned about is whether, you know, his being involved is going to instantly kill the show.
No, he's just directing an episode.
That's a joke, Michael. That's a joke. Is it too early?
It is too early. He's about to lose Dollhouse. But no, I'm very excited because, you know, he planned the Buffy musical episode for years. It was a great, great episode, even though the show was past its prime. And he's just, you know, doing an episode of the show, and it's really fun. The show isn't totally clicking for me yet, but I watch it every week. You know, it's definitely unusual.
You actually stopped watching Glee?
I stopped watching it. It became too just ridiculous, and it was so anti-woman, and I know you guys will be really surprised to hear me say something as anti-woman, but it was like all the women were just so just hateful, just horrible people, and I got bored.
You're right about the women. I think almost every character is kind of hateful, except maybe for the teacher and the very, very dumb male lead student. But yeah, but I am glad though that that show's been picked up for a full season, as has Southland. The mysterious episodes that were produced by NBC and then dropped because of Jay Leno are going to appear on TNT. So I'm glad about that, because I thought that show was quite good.
Well, that's if TNT and NBC can come to some form of financial arrangement. NBC pulled the plug on the show 2 weeks ago, and they pulled it before the show ever aired this season. They aired, I think, 7 episodes last year, and they had shot 13 for this year. And TNT is now saying they're going to pick up those episodes and air them before they commit to any more. But then on Deadline Hollywood, Nikki Fink said that NBC and TNT are arguing over money. So we'll see if that actually happens. NBC did, however, make a decision on Community. They picked up The Back Nine, and that's a show, a half-hour sitcom that I watched, and it's actually really funny.
It's a good show. It's a funny show. It's got a good cast, except for Jillian Jacobs, who plays the blonde object of Joel McHale's affection. I think it's got its moments, and then it's got its moments where it's just an ordinary sitcom.
I think it's weak, and it won't be back next season unless something bizarre happens. They have to have more in the hamper than that. You know, it's doing very mediocre numbers, but NBC is so desperate that they have to keep it on.
But they picked up Mercy, my favorite new show of the season.
I know, they did. That too is a surprise.
So excited.
Well, now it seems television is desperate as well. Karen, you highlighted a number of stories about my favorite subject. Can Hulu save traditional TV? And will Hulu get a paywall in 2010? Both of these are from Fast Company. And then Ad Age had a story called Do NBC, Universal, Fox, and Disney Need to Rethink Their Hulu Strategy? Can you fill us in on all these?
Well, really the bottom line is, like, what is Hulu's future? And in considering their future, they kind of look to how they've succeeded so far. And can they save traditional TV? Are they saving traditional TV by bringing in new viewers who are watching it online? Is this the way that people are going to watch TV? Is that hurting or helping the mothership? And then because they have to drive up their advertising, whether they're going to have to, or they have to make money, whether they're going to have a paywall, or, you know, what's the future, really? I mean, that's the bottom line of what this story is. How is Hulu going to make money, and how are they changing the way that we watch TV?
News Corp's deputy chairman Chase Carey, speaking at the recent on-screen summit, Carey plainly said it was time his company started getting paid for broadcast content online, mirroring his boss, Rupert Murdoch, who has said the same thing.
Todd, do you watch Hulu?
I don't. I spend so much time watching movies that I don't watch a lot of TV. However, all this stuff sort of brings up an interesting thing that I recently found out some interesting information about, which was I did an interview with this guy named Andrew Keen, who wrote a book, I believe it was called Cult of the Amateur. But basically, he sort of is a prophet for the evils of the democratization of the internet. And one of the things that I was lucky enough to interview, and one of the things he talked about, was the way in which the music industry has become sort of a paradigm or an example of what has sort of happened with all of these other forms of expression and all of these other sort of commercial spheres online, which is essentially that when the music industry exploded with downloading and file sharing and stuff like that, they never really bothered to find a way in which to monetize what they do successfully. And they kept saying they were going to do it, and they're like, we'll find something, and something will replace what we are losing in revenues in terms of CD sales or other physical sales. And the truth is that that they never did find anything that was a suitable substitute or a suitable structure to monetize that. And I think that that's essentially what's happening with something like Hulu, where, you know, people are now accustomed to getting their content more or less for free, whether they have to suffer through a couple of commercials or not. And so they, I think that once you have told people that they can get something for free and then telling them that they have to pay for it after they've already gotten it for free, I just think people aren't going to go for that. And they will find other ways to get that content without having to pay for it.
Well, I think you're right. But as always, the studios and everybody take the wrong lessons from iTunes and from digital music. The lesson was, if you make it available to people legally and inexpensively and easily, like iTunes finally did, they will flock to it and they will pay their money. People are not interested in stealing stuff. If you make it available to them easily and at a reasonable price, they'll do it. And that's exactly what they didn't do with music. They fought digital tooth and nail instead of seeing it as a new revenue stream. They killed the single because they wanted people to pay $16 for compact discs. They freaked out over Napster. They shut it down. They could have monetized that and turned that into their revenue stream right away. They still refused to license their music to let subscription services take off. In Europe, subscription services work really well because all the major labels sign on to it. And if they did that here, they could be getting $14 a month from all these music people who might suddenly say, wow, I can get every album available streaming on my phone or my car or my home for $14 a month. That's a lot of money when it adds up. And they just, instead, they go, oh my God, we can't do it. We have to run away from new technology. They hate every bit of new technology. VHS, CDs, DVDs, streaming audio, streaming video. They're petrified of any change and they're morons about it.
Well, and with Napster, they didn't even have to provide the product because it was peer-to-peer. Their customers were providing the product.
Well, the problem was that they saw that people wanted to have music available digitally, and they fought it. Instead of saying, well, let's us be the ones to make it available, they forced people to go to Napster and other illegal sites, which were illegal at the time, to get it. People couldn't buy a single in the record store. They did not release singles anymore. You wanted to buy a song off an album that you liked, you couldn't do it. They made it impossible. Now, at least, they've been smart enough to be involved with Hulu early on. They're realizing on YouTube, instead of pulling videos down, put a thing on some stupid home wedding video and say, hey, buy the single for a dollar. You know, you see the couple walking down the aisle dancing to the song. A million people watch the video. Instead of telling them to take it down, they've gotten a little smarter and said, hey, you can buy that single for a dollar. Every time you watch a thing on YouTube now that's sort of like unofficial use of music, a thing pops up saying, click here to buy the song. And they're getting a little smarter, but they're always scared of change.
What I find so incredibly interesting about it is that it's focused advertising. That, first of all, it kind of harkens back to the early days of TV where it's like sponsored by one brand, but that people can choose what ads they want to see. And in that case, you are targeting the exact customer you want to target because they're choosing to see your ad. That seems to me to be pretty brilliant.
And Saturday Night Live, the variety show, I guess, the sketch comedy show on Saturday night.
Let's go on. We've heard of it.
Okay. Just, you know, for our international listeners, it's on NBC at 11:30 Saturday night.
they have stock in it.
They have a whole episode that is going to be sponsored by, is it Anheuser-Busch or Budweiser?
I remember reading this, but I don't remember.
But it's a beer.
It was Budweiser.
Yeah, Budweiser. So that does harken back to the early days of television. But before we get off of music, I wanted to find out if any of you are big Lil Wayne fans, or I should say Lil Wayne, because he pleaded guilty to a gun charge this week in a New York City courtroom. He was found to have a gun on his possession or on his tour bus in Manhattan in 2007. Do any of you listen to Lil Wayne?
I definitely do. If you're a fan of hip hop at all, much less sort of contemporary pop music, like you sort of have to be aware of his stuff. And I definitely, I wasn't even really aware of this gun charge thing. Given the fact that he's recorded more albums in a year than anybody I've ever, I have ever seen. I mean, I think he just recorded, like, in between he did the Carter 2 and Carter 3, I think they were a couple of years apart, he recorded, like, 20 mixtapes, which was just him freestyling over beats.
Doesn't this just kind of add to his street cred? I mean, who cares?
Yeah, do you think it will affect his album sales?
No.
I think these kinds of things are really irrelevant. I mean, this is an irrelevant sort of offense, I think. I mean, like the Chris Brown incident with Rihanna, that's a little bit different, where I think people, where that's like the victimization of a woman, you know, all other things being equal, unfortunately, you know, is something that I think people are going to look down upon. Whereas, you know, for a rapper to be caught with a gun, you know, I mean, this is certainly not the first, and I guarantee it won't be the last. I mean, if anything, it raises his visibility. I'm not sure how much, as you were saying, credibility, you know, street cred, it will enhance his record sales, but it will make him even more of a sort of phenomenon than he already was.
Well, the 27-year-old rap artist is right now out on bail, $30,000 bail. And he is scheduled to be back in court on December 15th, and he will be sentenced in February. And it looks like he's going to go away for 1 year. He's going to spend his time on Rikers Island, a New York City prison, which is more like county lockup. I don't know why they're putting him on Rikers Island for a year as opposed to upstate somewhere.
Because Rikers Island sounds cool.
Well, the Lil Wayne story very much could be a part of our Big Deal or Big Whoop, which every week we review a couple of entertainment news stories and decide whether they are worth mentioning at all. Our first story is Roman Polanski faces 2 years in prison if returned to L.A., Swiss officials say. Swiss authorities said the director Roman Polanski could spend up to 2 years in prison if he was extradited back to the United States for sentencing in a sexual assault case. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. I'm sort of tired of hearing about Polanski.
Yeah, big whoop. This thing's been going on 25 years. I think it just needs to be resolved one way or the other. I'm not sure that any purpose would be served by him serving prison time, but at this point, it's big whoop.
Come on, Todd. This is your beat, your legal beat. We expect you to call up your lawyer friends.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I think it's a big whoop, yeah. Because I think the Swiss authorities have misread the information on what should be expected. I doubt seriously he'll see any jail time at this point.
And frankly, the Swiss officials have nothing to do with his sentencing. Moving on to Melrose Place, where Ashley Simpson Wentz and Colin Egglesfield are moving out of Melrose Place. The two regulars were, I guess, cut from the show.
Yeah.
Big deal or big whoop, Todd?
I would recuse myself from making a, since I don't think the show's a big deal to begin with, I would say
recuse.
Big whoop.
Recuse. Good legal word.
Ow. I'm going to say a little bit of both. I think it's a big whoop because I don't watch Melrose Place either, and I really don't care about either one of these two actors. But I think it's a big deal only in terms of Ashley Simpson Wentz's career, because they basically fired her because she wasn't bringing in viewers, which was the whole reason in hiring her. So it's a big deal for her acting career.
I say it's a big deal because it eerily mirrors the first season of the original Melrose Place, where they fired two regular cast members in the middle of the season.
I know, isn't that weird?
As Mark Berman pointed out on his Programming Insider email list that he does for Media Week. But yeah, the show is completely unimportant. And then CW is virtually non-existent except for the Vampire Diaries. So big whoop.
Now, I probably should have led with this story because it feeds off of the Lil Wayne story. Kanye West is not dead despite net rumor frenzy. And I noticed this on Twitter. There was a leading trending topic, R.I.P. Kanye West, and I thought, what the heck? It was an internet hoax that first surfaced on Tuesday, October 20th, which spun into a massive frenzy of web rumors on social networking sites like Twitter and Facebook. The prank was a setup of a Fox News webpage headlining West's death in a bizarre car crash in Los Angeles. The fraudulent website that churned out the news of West's faux death has been taken down, and this was according to Billboard.com. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
I would say it would be a big deal had we paired it with the Balloon Boy story, because then we could comment about how we are a society totally obsessed with reality shows and, you know, using the internet to put up hoaxes, and that probably would have been a bigger deal. But frankly, it's sort of a big whoop.
It was a big whoop because it wasn't a very effective hoax, I don't think.
Well, here's why I think it very well may be a big deal. Because when this rumor started to spread on Twitter and Facebook and other sites, it was very quickly squashed by Kanye West, by his girlfriend. They turned to fans themselves right through the same services to say, no, none of this is true. And so finally, a medium has arrived on the scene where a celebrity can turn to their fans directly and immediately and put an end to a rumor before it spins completely out of control. But moving on to Oscar having two new producers, Bill Mechanic and Adam Shankman. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I put this on because I thought I'd been reading a lot about how producing the Oscars is such a thankless job. So I think it's kind of nice that Bill Mechanic, who I always thought did a really good job over at Fox, I thought it was nice that, you know, he gets a gig. Adam Shankman is, you know, sort of ubiquitous at this point, so I could take or leave him. But is it a big deal? No, not really. But, you know, it's kind of nice. Of course, we just found out that Ricky Gervais is going to host it. Is that a big deal or a big whoop?
No. Ricky Gervais is doing the Golden Globes. He's a good fit.
Oh, he's doing the Golden Globes?
He'd be a terrible choice for the Oscars, but he's a good choice for the Golden Globes. What do you think, Todd, about Ricky Gervais and the new producers of the Oscar show?
I would say that it is a big deal in comparison to the fact that Bill Condon was the guy who did it last year. And, you know, Adam Shankman, if you just look at their efforts to make, I mean, I liked Hairspray, don't get me wrong, but Dreamgirls in comparison to Hairspray, I mean, it's you know, Adam Shankman to say is the poor man's Bill Condon.
Well, I think it's a big whoop in my opinion, only because actually I don't even have an opinion on this. I could care less whether it's a big deal or a big whoop. You know, I'll just watch the show when it airs and that'll be that, you know, and we'll move on. In fact,
speaking of moving on. Segway alert.
Yes. Inside Baseball, our weekly look at stories that only people in Hollywood may care about. This week, I highlighted a story that plays off of our special episode on which we talked about whether bloggers are breaking journalistic rules, and it was in the LA Times blog. I don't know which blog it was on, but it was on their website. The headline was, "Pricey Tropical Junket Pays Off for Couples Retreat." And it appeared right after Couples Retreat won their opening weekend. And one of the things written here says, one of the keys to the strong $35.3 million opening of Couples Retreat was the oldest of Hollywood marketing ploys, the glitzy media junket. Universal flew dozens of journalists to Bora Bora for interviews with the cast in the same tropical setting where the film took place, as described by writer James Rocky on MSN, and by the way, also on this show. The all-expenses-paid trip also included activities such as watching sharks and feeding stingrays. Michael, I know you have a very strong opinion on how wrong this is. And earlier this week, I was listening to This Week in Tech with Leo Laporte, and they had a huge argument over this as well, with people taking both sides of the argument. And really, the one thing that they did mention is that when you get a freebie, when you get a piece of electronic equipment, you should mention it in your piece. But that if somebody is holding an event, and they decide to hold that event in London, and there's going to be breaking news, that it's up to the company to make sure the journalists are there. And in certain cases, people cannot afford to either A, hire a stringer, a freelance writer, or B, even have the time or resources to do so.
What about you, Todd? Have you ever been flown out of the country or flown somewhere by a studio or somebody that you were doing a story on them?
Yes, I have. And I have very strong opinions on this myself. And my feeling about this question, and I'm good friends with James Rocky, and I really enjoyed the piece that he wrote for MSN. But, you know, I don't agree with the degree of self-flagellation that he subjects himself to in that article, in the sense that, I mean, I've been a freelancer for 8 years, you know, and I have gone to junkets in Marina Del Rey. I've gone to junkets in Hollywood. I've gone to junkets in London. And I've received DVDs to review. I've received Blu-rays to review. I've gone to events. I have, you know, spoken to people in like filmmakers and social situations and junkets. And I think that ultimately, my belief, particularly in an age in which I think that the lines between old and new media, which is often brought up as sort of an example, as a way of elevating one over the other, I think that ultimately it comes down only to one thing, which is personal integrity or the integrity of the outlet for which you work. And, you know, because the truth is, and I'm actually paraphrasing James in this, is that, you know, there are people that you could take to Starbucks and they would like something more because you gave them a free coffee. Or if you go to a screening, I mean, there are people who go to screenings on a regular basis to review movies, but the people who get in get free parking and a free popcorn. That makes them like that movie better. And so if you have a degree of personal integrity as a professional doing this job, then you are not then my belief, at least as far as my body of work is concerned, is that I'm not adversely affected by the opportunity to go someplace for a set visit or for anything else. And in my opinion, if you think that that's a conflict of interest, then you shouldn't go and do that. And then you should feel free to write about whatever. And furthermore, on Friday mornings, go watch every movie, pay for it yourself, and then you can tear every movie a new one, or you can love it or whatever, and your opinion will be, you know, free from any possibility of compromise. But the truth is that this is not a limited to entertainment journalism. I don't know that there's such thing as objectivity, but I do think that there is a way that you have to make a judgment the way in which you cover something to maintain your personal and professional integrity.
This is something that James couldn't get off. He felt that implying that you shouldn't accept when possible, you should avoid accepting a free travel trip from a studio was somehow implying he would write a nice review. But that's not the point. It creates a conflict of interest regardless of what story you write or how you review a movie. It just doesn't. I mean, if you if a congressman takes $1,000 from a lobbyist and then he says, well, yeah, but I voted against the bill anyway that the lobbyist wanted me to vote for, that's not the point. You can't take money from lobbyists. And if you can avoid it from a studio, you should. I'm sure you don't take it willy-nilly. You only do it under circumstances where you feel like there's no other way to get the story and you have to do it and you really need the story and there's no other way around it and you feel it's important. My argument is simply that Couples Retreat was not a film he needed to be on the set for. You know, there was just not an essential movie to be on the set for. He didn't have any anticipation it would be an important or good movie. In fact, he had quite the opposite, and it was borne out.
Sure. I mean, I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with that. I certainly did not go on that trip to Bora Bora. But I do think that depending on the way in which you are reporting on something, and I say this because this is not typically the way that I work, but I mean, if you're in Entertainment Tonight and you want to provide, and you're reporting on Couples Retreat, and you want to be able to provide an interesting context for your report, then to fly to Bora Bora to cover that is not an uninteresting way to do that.
It's really not a gift when a studio flies a journalist from Los Angeles to Bora Bora or Los Angeles to Hawaii to cover the opening of Pearl Harbor. There's nothing actually changing hands other than a studio travel rep calling you and telling you you're going to be on flight X at such and such a time, and you have to be there because that's the flight all the journalists are on.
The IRS disagrees with you because that would be a gift, and you would have to include that in your taxes. Talk to your tax attorney. And again, what were the descriptions of the events that took place? Oh, they went shark watching and this and that and the other thing. You know, and again, there are a lot of positive options that you can use if you're a journalist, especially in the online world, that are think outside the box. We have a friend who goes to Cannes, and this year he said, I can't afford to go to Cannes. He's a freelance writer, and his outlet couldn't afford to send him. So he turned to his readers, and he said, look, he's got hundreds of followers, if not thousands. And he said, look, I can't afford to go this year. If you want me to go and do my coverage, if you can chip in and we can all raise, you know, $1,200 or however many dollars it is, I can go to Cannes. And he raised the money. You know, if you had a chance to go on the set of The Hobbit and the studio offered it to you and not a lot of people were going there, I can see why you'd really want to go do that, why there'd be a huge interest. And I bet if you turned to your fans at Cinematical or where elsewhere and said, look, I have this opportunity, my website can't afford to send me. If you want this story and we can raise enough money, I'll be able to go. I'd rather do that than take the money from the studio. Give them the option. You'd be surprised about the support you can get.
Well, it doesn't seem like it's going to be an issue that A has an easy answer, as we documented on our special episode. And it certainly doesn't seem like it's going to end anytime soon. Certainly, as the Los Angeles Times points out, such lavish events are far less common in Hollywood today, as cost-conscious studios are not only cutting back on expenses, but also trying to avoid ostentatious signs of overspending. And this is really what I wanted to bring up this story for. And I'm quoting the LA Times piece. They write, "One source close to the film said the studio spent twice as much as it normally does on the couple's retreat junket. The extra money was taken from spending that typically would have gone to other advertising and publicity. The source felt confident that the investment was worth it, noting that the couple's retreat junket generated around 10 times as much media coverage as such events typically do." And that is why they do this.
That was a very self-serving, vague blog item, and I'd love to have more specific information about how they got 10 times as much coverage of couples retreat as they normally would, because that's hard to quantify, and I don't buy it at all. I think it was just the studio trying to, you know, there's maybe a little bad buzz coming out there about the junket, and they said, oh, no, it really worked. It was very effective. It was a lavish junket, and they could have accomplished the same thing probably back in Hollywood.
Just briefly to address the point that you made before about sort of sourcing your readership for potential donations or whatever, I'm not sure that I feel like that's a realistic option for many freelancers, including myself. I mean, you know, I write anywhere between, you know, 10 to 15 articles per week, and that includes transcription, that includes attending as many as 4 or 5 screenings per week. And that's just so that I can pay my bills, you know, pay my rent, take care of, you know, everything that I need to. You know, I mean, honestly, as cynical as this may sound, I really do think that the vast majority of what we do as entertainment journalists is essentially publicity for the studios. And you know, what if I'm interviewing Naomi Watts for Funny Games, or I'm interviewing her for King Kong, or for anything else, I'm still just promoting their movie. You know, and the place where my personal voice actually comes in is in reviewing that movie. And so if I am, you know, given the opportunity to have cocktails with Naomi Watts and sit down with her, and they pay for me to have 3 or 4 drinks, and so we get to talk for 2 hours, and then I write an article about that, as far as I'm concerned, I don't enter my personal feelings about that into it.
I imagine you choose, when you can, to write articles about movies you're enthusiastic about. You're not going to write about a piece of junk unless for some reason you have to. It's the editor begs you to, or there's a hole that week or whatever.
No, that's actually not true. I have on many occasions seen a movie that I deeply disliked, and I get excited when I get a chance to do the interviews for that movie. I mean, because I like to ask the filmmakers how and why they made decisions that they made. And that's as valuable and entertaining and interesting to me as it is to, you know, support a movie that I liked. I mean, I've certainly seen a lot of movies this year that I loved, and then I was like, well, I have nothing to ask these people. You know, I have nothing to write about. I'm like, I like the movie. There's nothing else for me to really say about it. The opportunity to write about something that is challenging, valuable, and interesting to me outweighs any level of whether or not I like that thing.
Well, Todd, thank you very much for joining us today to talk about the week's top entertainment news stories. Is there a place where we should be sending listeners to read some of your stories besides Cinematical and Sci-Fi Wire? Do you have a site you want to plug?
Well, you definitely should check out bitterlawyer.com. I mean, it's a great, really interesting website. Like I said, right now, primarily I do film criticism for them. But, you know, in the next couple of weeks, I'll probably be doing some feature and interview work. But they write some really fascinating features there. You can look up, you know, sort of the entirety of my reviews on Rotten Tomatoes if you go to my author page, Todd Gilchrist. Then I've got, I think, about 750 reviews on there. So I encourage people to look there and check them out.
And you can find everything out about Michael Giltz by going to michaelgiltz.com or following him on Twitter. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. Karen is also on Twitter. She is @kwoody3939, and you can read some of her stories on industrynexus.com.
And on KarenWoodwardOnline.com.
Oh, really? What is this, a new website?
No, it's my personal website that's been up for a while, but I was working on it. I still am working on it, but that's where you can find a lot of my stuff.
I'll definitely check it out. I can be found on Celluloid Junkie or on Twitter. My username is @Sperling. And we mentioned earlier in the show, our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. If you want to send us an email with feedback or comments on the show or any of the stories we discussed, Please feel free. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can find links to all of the stories we discussed on this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll also find links to all of our social networking sites, including Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, all the usual suspects. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of Showbiz Sandbox is by the popular indie group Management, or MGMT. They can be found on MySpace at myspace.com/MGMT, or you can find them on their website, whoismgmt.com. Until next week, play nice.